2 Samuel 1-2, the first talk in a series in 2 Samuel, was presented by David Crabtree on February 8, 2009 at Reformation Fellowship. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2009. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed, in whole, for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction. All other rights reserved.
We'll be looking at the first two chapters of 2 Samuel today. First Samuel ended with the big battle between the Philistines and the Israelites in the Valley of Jezreel. And in that battle, Saul and his two sons, Jonathan and Abinadab, and Malachi, Shua, three sons, all died in that battle. So now we're going to switch back to David and see. We find David just as he is learning of the death of Saul. The first 10 verses of chapter 1 of 2 Samuel. Now it came about after the death of Saul, when David had returned from the slaughter of the Amalekites, that David remained 2 days in Ziklag. And it happened on the third day that, behold, a man came out of the camp from Saul, with his clothes torn and dust on his head. And it came about when he came to David that he fell to the ground and prostrated himself. Then David said to him, "From where do you come?" And he said to him, "I have escaped from the camp of Israel." And David said to him, "How did things go? Please tell me." And he said, "The people have fled from the battle, and also many of the people have fallen and are dead. And Saul and Jonathan his son are dead also." So David said to the young man who told him, "How do you know that Saul and his son Jonathan are dead?" And the young man who told him said, "By chance I happened to be on Mount Gilboa, and behold, Saul was leaning on his spear, and behold, the chariots and the horsemen pursued him closely. And when he looked behind him, he saw me and called to me. And I said, 'Here I am.' And he said to me, 'Who are you?' And I answered him, 'I am an Amalekite.' Then he said to me, 'Please stand beside me and kill me, for agony has seized me because my life still lingers in me.' So I stood beside him and killed him, because I knew that he could not live after he had fallen. And I took the crown which was on his head and the bracelet which was on his arm, and I have brought them here to my Lord." So this is just a couple days, apparently, after David has returned from defeating the Amalekites. Remember, the Amalekites had raided Ziklag. They had taken all the men, women, and children from Ziklag as hostages, as captives. They were going to sell them into slavery. They had fled into the desert in the Negev. And David and his men went after them, defeated them, and took back all of the captives that they had taken. Returns back to Ziklag, and he has been in Ziklag for a couple of days when this man shows up. It's a young man. David doesn't know who this man is. He comes, and he is, his clothes are torn, and he has dust on him. Probably in a sign of mourning. So this is an ominous sight right from the very beginning, that this messenger is coming and has all the signs of being in mourning. This man comes. He bowed down before David, and David starts to speak to him. He says, "Where do you come from?" He says, "I have escaped from the camp of Israel." It's already ominous. He has escaped from the camp of Israel. It sounds like something bad has happened already. So David follows that up and says, well, how did things go? He wants a report. What's happened? He knows that this guy has some kind of knowledge of what happened in this battle at the north. And David has probably been very anxious to hear what has happened at that battle. The report is that the people have fled from the battle, and also many of the people have fallen and are dead, and Saul and Jonathan and his son are dead also. So the report is as bad as David could have believed, that the Israel was routed, the army of Israel fled in the battle in the face of the Philistine might. Many have died, and among those are Saul the king and Jonathan in particular, his son are dead. But David seems to be a little dubious. There's something that doesn't quite add up. David says to the young man, how do you know that Saul and his son are dead? David wants something more than just this man's word that this has happened. He wants something that he can hang his hat on. And so this young man gives his account of what happened. And he begins it by saying that by chance he was on Mount Gilboa. So this is not someone who would be normally, apparently, in Saul's entourage. This is someone whose duties probably would not otherwise have had him right in the middle of the battle. But at this particular point in time, that's where he was, right where the battle and right where Saul and his sons were killed. And what he says is he saw Saul leaning on his spear. Interestingly, this was probably the same spear that he had thrown at David. It's probably the same spear that David had stolen at one point when he snuck into the camp at night and took Saul's spear from Saul and snuck out of the camp. So Saul's leaning on this spear. There are chariots coming. Chariots would have been, in all likelihood, chariots were like the ancient version of a tank. Some of them had two people in them, some of them had three in them. Usually there would be one driver and two fighters. And the two fighters usually would be archers. And these chariots would have been at the advance of the battle lines, probably. That the chariots would have made it further than the infantrymen would have been. They would have been following up behind. So the chariots, as he's describing the battle scene where Saul and his sons are, the Philistine chariots have made their way to them. And we're pursuing closely. And so as he describes it then, Saul is leaning on the chair, on his spear, and he looks behind him, and he sees this man. And Saul says, Saul called to him, and this man says, here I am. And then Saul says, who are you? So this is not someone that Saul recognizes. This is not someone that's regularly around Saul. And his answer is, I am an Amalekite. And then Saul says, well, I'm badly wounded. Please come over, be by me, stand by me, and kill me. Take my life so that I don't have to suffer at the hands of the Philistines. And so this young man says, he responded. He went over by Saul and he killed Saul because he knew that Saul was about to die. So he's being of service to Saul. And then he took from Saul the crown and the bracelet And he has brought those to David, and he shows those to David. So here is tangible evidence that Saul and his sons have died, and that what this young man has to say is true. Next section. Then David took hold of his clothes and tore them. And so also did all the men who were with him. And they mourned and wept and fasted until evening for Saul and his son Jonathan and for the people of the Lord and the house of Israel, because they had fallen by the sword. And David said to the young man who told him, "Where are you from?" And he answered, "I am the son of an alien, an Amalekite." Then David said to him, "How is it you were not afraid to stretch out your hand to destroy the Lord's anointed?" And David called one of the young men and said, "Go, cut him down." So he struck him, and he died. And David said to him, "Your blood is on your head, for your mouth has testified against you, saying, 'I have killed the Lord's anointed.'" So having heard this news, David is convinced that it is in fact true that Saul and his sons have died. And David and his men go into mourning. And I think, given the whole narrative up to now, I think that's sincere. David has respected Saul throughout, and we'll see as we read the song that David composed on this occasion, that there's a lot of sincerity in that. They're mourning the death of Saul, that is the king of Israel, Jonathan his son, the people of the Lord, and the house of Israel. In that order, then, they're mourning. Saul, because he's the king, the anointed. Jonathan, because he was one of their main military leaders, and I think in particular was a friend of David's. The people of Israel, I think in particular, is talking about those soldiers who died. And then the house of Israel, that is the whole nation and what the nation is experiencing at this point in time, at this very significant defeat. Then David turns to this young man. He's got some more questions. "Where are you from?" And the answer is, this man is the son of an alien. An alien would be someone who has lived in Israel and has been assimilated into the Israelite culture. But his lineage is from an Amalekite. So he's of Amalekite descent, but in all likelihood, this young man was born and raised in Israel. So he's enculturated as an Israelite, but of Amalekite descent. So then David asks him, "How is it you were not afraid to stretch out your hand to destroy the Lord's anointed?" If you've been enculturated as an Israelite, if you know what it means for someone to be the anointed of God, the king that God has placed there, then how is it that you were so disrespectful as to take the life of the king? And so David commands one of his soldiers to kill this Amalekite, and he does so. And David's statement is, "Your blood is on your head, for your mouth has testified against you, saying, 'I have killed the Lord's anointed.'" Okay, let's piece this together a little bit. The story that the Amalekite tells is at variance with the account that we have at the end of 1 Samuel. And the question is, are they just different but compatible accounts, or is there a significant difference? And if there's a significant difference, what do we do with that? For the most part, the accounts are indeed compatible, it seems to me. In both accounts, we have Saul being wounded. In 1 Samuel, it talks about him being shot with arrows. In this account, in 2 Samuel, It talks about the chariots being close by. That's compatible. The chariots would have had archers in them. It makes a lot of sense. That fits together. In this account in 2 Samuel, it says that Saul was leaning on his spear. We don't have that detail in 1 Samuel, but that makes sense as well. He's badly wounded. We know that from 1 Samuel. And apparently he's leaning on his spear just to hold him up. In 2 Samuel, then, it says that there's no mention of the armor bearer in 2 Samuel at all. And in 1 Samuel, if you'll recall, the armor bearer was there. And Saul turned to the armor bearer and said, "I'm badly wounded. Please run me through with your sword. Please take my life so that I don't have to suffer at the hands of the Philistines." In this account, in 2 Samuel, no mention of the armor bearer. All we have is mention of the Amalekite. And according to this account, then, Saul asked for the Amalekite to come over and kill him after first asking him where he's from. Apparently, Saul could tell that he's not an Israelite soldier. Saul may not know exactly whether he's Philistine or whether he's an Israelite. So he asks him where he's from and finds out that he is an Amalekite, and then Saul asks him to kill him. I suspect that he wanted to make sure that he was on the right side. It could also be that he's suggesting that it would have been easier for an Amalekite to kill him than an Israelite to kill him. I'm not sure. So then we have, in 2 Samuel, we have the Amalekite actually putting to death Saul. That is at variance, that is clearly at variance with what we have in 1 Samuel. Because in 1 Samuel, the armor bearer refuses to do it, so Saul runs himself through. And we know that that was effective because in 1 Samuel it tells us that when he was dead, then the armor bearer killed himself. So the armor bearer waits until Saul is dead, and once Saul is dead, then he kills himself. I think that we have to go with the account in 1 Samuel, because that account is the narrator's account. The narrator is telling us what happened. In 2 Samuel, everything we have about the death of Saul is from the mouth of this Amalekite. Then, according to the Amalekite, Saul is dead. The Amalekite has just killed him. And the Amalekite takes his crown and his bracelet. It's interesting that he would pick those things to take to David. It's not clear to me whether exactly what is going on in the mind of the Amalekite. I don't know whether he is thinking in terms of looting, that he will take these items and sell them, or, and I think this is probably more likely, he's thinking not in terms of loot, but in terms of what could he take to David and ingratiate himself to David? What could he take that David would be particularly appreciative of receiving and therefore be willing to reward this Amalekite for having done so? It is interesting, there are other things that he could have taken. If he just wants to prove that he was there, he could have taken the tassels that earlier David had taken the tassels. Those are identifying tassels. Every Israelite would have had distinctive tassels that would have identified who they were. He could have taken those and proved that he was there with Saul. He could have taken something else, but he takes the crown and he takes the bracelet. He takes the signs of authority, the signs of power. And that's what he takes to David. So when David receives these things, he's suspicious. And so he asks this man, "Where are you from?" And the man says he's an Amalekite. He's a resident alien. David apparently asked that to make sure that this is someone who should have known better than to take Saul's life. This is someone who understands Israelite culture, someone who understands the significance of the anointed. And I think David has pieced together everything, all of the information. He was suspicious at the very beginning. And I'm not sure exactly what gave rise to those suspicions at the very beginning. Then he hears the story, and I don't know whether he believes the story or not. But in any case, whether the Amalekite actually killed Saul or is just lying that he killed Saul, it indicates a willingness to kill Saul and not a respect for the anointed. And as a result of that, of I think what David perceives to be an attitude of disrespect for Saul and an interest in capitalizing on this event that he has happened to be present at, David decides that this is one who does not respect Saul, does not respect God's anointed, and he immediately has him killed. Next section. Then David chanted with his lament over Saul and Jonathan his son, and he told them to teach the sons of Judah the song of the bow. Behold, it is written in the book of Jashar, "Your beauty, O Israel, is slain on your high places. How have the mighty fallen? Tell it not in Gath, proclaim it not in the streets of Ashkelon, lest the daughters of the Philistines rejoice, lest the daughters of the circumcised exult. O mountains of Gilboa, let not dew or rain be on you, nor fields of offerings. For there the shield of the mighty was defiled, the shield of Saul, not anointed with oil. From the blood of the slain, from the fat of the mighty, the bow of Jonathan did not turn back, and the sword of Saul did not return empty. Saul and Jonathan, beloved and pleasant in their life, and in their death they were not parted. They were swifter than eagles. They were stronger than lions. O daughters of Israel, weep over Saul, who clothed you luxuriously in scarlet, who put ornaments of gold on your apparel. How have the mighty fallen in the midst of the battle? Jonathan is slain on your high places. I am distressed for you, my brother Jonathan. You have been very pleasant to me. Your love to me was more wonderful than the love of women. How have the mighty fallen and the weapons of war perished?" So David composed this song on this occasion. It's a lament over Saul and Jonathan in particular. And he instructs this is something that the people of Judah are to teach to their sons, to teach to their sons as something that will be passed down and remembered. And it says it is written in the book of Jashar. We don't have the book of Jashar. I wish we had the book of Jashar. In fact, I was talking to a young woman this week who wrote her doctoral dissertation on literacy in ancient Israel. And I was asking her about the book of Jashar and any other books that she might have in her library. And she thinks that there was, the evidence seems to indicate that there would have been a fairly large body of literature, she says, by 700 or 800, so that's a little bit later than we're reading about right now. But she's convinced that the book of Jashar and some of the other books that are mentioned in the Old Testament really did exist, and were in a library someplace at some point in time, and hopefully we'll still find it. But this poem was recorded in the book of Jashar. It starts out saying that the beauty, your beauty, O Israel, is slain on your high places. How have the mighty fallen? This is a devastating thing that's happened to Israel. That basically Saul's army has been wiped out. And not only Saul's army, but Saul and his sons have all been killed. And I think that that's what it means when it says, your beauty, O Israel. It's the cream of the crop. It's their best men have died. And it says on the high places, which is a curious thing, term to use here. The high places, as you are probably aware, is the name of the area, the raised areas where the Canaanites used to give their sacrifices. And then the Israelites sometimes did that as well. And the term here is the same term for these raised platforms on which sacrifices were given. So it's kind of a curious term to be used in this context. It's indicating, it suggests the idea of some kind of sacrifice being made. It goes on to say, tell it not in Gath, proclaim it not in the streets of Ashkelon. So Gath was at the southern end of the Philistine territory, Ashkelon at the northern area, so it seems to be referring to the entire Philistine area. Don't let this be proclaimed. Don't let people rejoice over this news. This is lest the daughters of the Philistines rejoice. We're going to have the daughters of the Philistines here later on in the poem. It's the daughters of Israel. And that seems to be the those who are in the position of being defended back home. They don't let them be encouraged by this that has happened. Then David addresses the mountains of Gilboa, where this battle took place. And he says, don't let rain or dew fall on you. Don't let your ground be fertile. Don't let things grow there. Because that's where Saul fell. And Saul, the Messiah of Israel, the anointed. Then he speaks in praise of Jonathan and Saul. Jonathan with his bow was, I think the idea is Jonathan was very successful and very valiant in his use of the bow against the Philistines. Saul in his use of the sword against the Philistines. Both of them accomplished a great deal. Then, speaking personally about Saul and Jonathan, they were much beloved, and David enjoyed them. And I think he's sincere in this, certainly sincere with respect to Jonathan, but I suspect he's sincere with respect to Saul as well. And Saul and Jonathan were loyal to one another throughout their lives, and that is remarkable, especially with respect to Jonathan. And they died together as well. He compares them to being swifter than eagles and stronger than lions. They were mighty warriors, both of them. So he turns to the daughters of Israel and says, weep over Saul. He says, who clothed you luxuriously in scarlet, who put ornaments of gold on your apparel. And I think this is suggesting that under Saul's rule, Israel became more prosperous. And this prosperity is due to Saul's accomplishments, and they should be thankful for that. Then he talks about Jonathan, how the mighty have fallen in the midst of the battle. Jonathan is slain on your high places. So once again, that same term. And all of this is directed in specifically to Jonathan, with whom he was, to whom he was particularly affectionate I'm distressed for you, my brother Jonathan. You have been very pleasant to me. Your love to me was more wonderful than the love of women. There is much made of the relationship between David and Jonathan in some quarters, and suggesting it was a homosexual relationship. I don't think that we should take this to indicate as evidence of that. I don't think there's any reason to think that there was a homosexual relationship between the two. But they were very close and were very affectionate one towards the other. And then just ends the song, how the mighty have fallen and the weapons of war perished. The weapons of war, or the instruments of war, I think, being the soldiers of Israel, and Saul and Jonathan in particular. Next section. Then it came about afterwards that David inquired of the Lord, saying, "Shall I go up to one of the cities of Judah?" And the Lord said to him, "Go up." So David said, "Where shall I go up?" And he said, "To Hebron." So David went up there, and his two wives also, Ahinoam the Jezreelitess, and Abigail, the widow of Nabal the Carmelite. And David brought up his men who were with him, each with his household, and they lived in the cities of Hebron. Then the men of Judah came, and there anointed David king over the house of Judah. And they told David, saying, "It was the men of Jabesh-Gilead who buried Saul." And David sent messengers to the men of Jabesh-Gilead and said to them, "May you be blessed of the Lord because you have shown this kindness to Saul your Lord and have buried him. And now may the Lord show loving kindness and truth to you, and I also will show this goodness to you because you have done this thing. Now, therefore, let your hands be strong and be valiant, for Saul your Lord is dead, and also the house of Judah has anointed me king over them." So David has heard the news of the battle and the death of Saul, and so David inquires of the Lord. David clearly wanted to be in Israel if at all possible. That was always the case. He went to Philistia only because he had no other choice. So now he consults of the Lord, "Should I go back? Is this the time to go back?" And the response to David is, "Yes, go back and take everybody with you." So David takes his men, takes his family, takes his wives, and they all go to Hebron. And there he is anointed as king over the house of Judah. So Judah is just one of the 12 tribes of Israel, but David is anointed king over Judah, which is, it may be just one of the tribes, but it's one of the larger tribes of Israel at this time. So David has become king of Judah. He's not yet king of all Israel. And David responds to the men of Jabesh-Gilead. If you will recall, early in Saul's reign, he had come to the rescue of Jabesh-Gilead when it was being besieged. I think it was the Philistines who were besieging Jabesh-Gilead. Saul came to their defense and routed them and won back Jabesh-Gilead for Israel. So when Saul was killed by the Philistines, and the Philistines took his body and the sons of Saul's bodies and mounted all of them on the wall of the city wall of Bethshan, the men of Jabesh-Gilead heard about that, this dishonoring of Saul and his sons. And so they snuck to Bethshan, removed the bodies of Saul and his sons, and took them back to Jabesh-Gilead and gave them a proper burial, giving them due respect. David appreciated that. It was a brave thing to do, and it was a very noble thing to do. So David sends a message to them, And saying, may you be blessed of the Lord because you have shown this kindness to Saul your Lord and have buried him. I think David is truly grateful for what they've done and asks that God may be extend his blessing to them and that David will show his goodness to them as well because of what they have done. Okay, next section. But Abner, the son of Ner, commander of Saul's army, had taken Ishbosheth, the son of Saul, and brought him over to Mahanaim. And he made him king over Gilead, over the Asherites, over Jezreel, over Ephraim, and over Benjamin, even over all Israel. Ishbosheth, Saul's son, was 40 years old when he became king over Israel, and he was king for 2 years. The house of Judah, however, followed David, and the time that David was king in Hebron over the house of Judah was 7 years and 6 months. Let me stop here and talk about this just a little bit. The chronology is not real clear here, but apparently what has happened is Abner, who, if you'll recall, was one of the main commanders under Saul. Abner has fought on behalf of the one remaining son of Saul, and that's Ishbosheth. Remember, 3 of his sons died with him on Mount Gilboa, but one of them apparently was not there, Ishbosheth. He was younger, and Abner champions his cause and apparently fights to make him king of Israel. And he is placed in Mahanaim, which is on the east side of the Jordan, in Transjordan. So apparently there's been time that has passed after the battle between the Israelites and the Philistines, and the Israelites have fought back the gains that the Philistines had made. And apparently that took several years to do. And apparently Ishbosheth was not technically the king during that period of time when Abner is leading the forces against the Philistines and driving them back. Because it says that Ishbosheth was king over Israel for 2 years, and it says that David was king over Judah for 7.5 years. Well, David becomes king over all of Israel at the same time that Ishbosheth ceases to be king over Israel. So apparently there's a period of about 5.5 years when Abner is fighting against the Philistines and trying to put together a coalition that will support Ishbosheth as king. So that seems to be what's happened here. So Abner is in all likelihood the power behind the throne. Ishbosheth owes his kingship to Abner, and that becomes apparent later on in the narrative. During this last 2 years, after Ishbosheth is installed as king, a civil war erupts between Abner and his forces and David and his forces. And we see a manifestation of that in the next section. Now Abner, the son of Ner, went out from Mahanaim to Gibeon with the servants of Ishbosheth, the son of Saul. And Joab, the son of Zeruiah, and the servants of David went out and met them by the pool of Gibeon. And they sat down, one on one side of the pool, and the other on the other side of the pool. Then Abner said to Joab, "Now let the young men arise and hold a contest before us." And Joab said, "Let them arise." So they arose and went over by count 12 for Benjamin and Ishbosheth, the son of Saul, and 12 of the servants of David. And each one of them seized his opponent by the head and thrust his sword in his opponent's side. So they fell down together. Therefore, that place was called Helkath Hazurim, which is in Gibeon. And that day the battle was very severe, and Abner and the men of Israel were beaten before the servants of David. So the civil war has burst out. There's fighting between David's men and Abner's men. And probably that's going on fairly constantly. This is just talking about one battle that occurs. And this battle occurs at Gibeon. Gibeon would have been at the northern edge of Judah, probably just north of the northern edge of Judah. So that's where the fight is the fiercest. The struggle is the fiercest. Gibeon, as you will recall, back in Joshua, in the book of Joshua, was the city that sent some messengers to Joshua as the Israelites were coming into the land. And they were convinced that the Israelites were going to take all of Canaan. They wanted to be on the winning side. So they sent messengers wanting to form a peace treaty with the Israelites. And they pretended to be from a long ways away. And in fact, they were only a few miles south of where the Israelites were at that particular point in time. So the Gibeonites are not of the bloodline of Abraham, but they were incorporated and assimilated into Israelite culture. They are Israelites, but they said that they were wanted to be a part of Israel, even if they were wood carriers. So Gibeon is the place where those people are that had wanted to have a peace treaty with the Israelites when they first came into the land. The battle develops into a stalemate with Abner's men on one side and Joab, the commander of David's forces, on the other side of this pool at Gibeon. And they have a clever idea. They decide, instead of fighting it out, let's just each select 12 men, and they can fight it out, and whoever wins is the winner. And that way, the rest of us can sit back and take it easy and not get killed. On my knowledge of history and the other times when this has been tried, I would recommend that if you're in this situation, don't do it. It never works. I suspect that what happens is both sides are all for it until the battle starts happening. And as you're cheering on your side, there are always going to be infractions. From your perspective, there are always going to be infractions committed by the other side. They cheat. Having no instant replay, it's difficult to substantiate those charges that the other side cheated. But I suspect that it's very commonplace for you to look at your side and say, that wasn't fair. They didn't do that right. Nah, nah, nah. And this is not a fair contest. And so at the end of it, it's always going to erupt into a full-out war between the two sides anyway. And that's typically what happens. That's exactly what happens here. Apparently, the fighting between the two groups of 12 was very fierce. It describes it as grabbing the other person by the hair and stabbing him in the side with a knife. And apparently both sides are doing that. And so that's close-in fighting with a lot of blood being shed. But it says that David's men were victorious in this 12-on-12 combat. But that will not be the end of the story. Verse 18. Now the three sons of Zeruiah were there, Joab and Abishai and Asahel. And Asahel was as swift-footed as one of the gazelles which is in the field. And Asahel pursued Abner and did not turn to the right or to the left from following Abner. Then Abner looked behind him and said, "Is that you, Asahel?" And he answered, "It is I." So Abner said to him, "Turn to your right or to your left and take hold of one of the young men for yourself and take for yourself his spoil." But Asahel was not willing to turn aside from following him. And Abner repeated again to Asahel, "Turn aside from following me. Why should I strike you to the ground? How then could I lift up my face to your brother Joab?" However, he refused to turn aside. Therefore, Abner struck him in the belly with the butt end of his spear, so that the spear came out at his back. And he fell there and died on the spot. And it came about that all who came to the place where Asahel had fallen and died stood still. We've already run into the encountered in the narrative the sons of Zeruiah. Zeruiah is David's sister, I think it is. And the three sons of Zeruiah are Abishai, who, if you'll recall, was the young man who volunteered to go with David to sneak into the camp of the Philistines at night and steal Saul's spear. Asahel's the one in this particular incident. He's the one who's very fast. And the other one is Joab. Joab is David's main commander. So all of these three are significant in among David's 600 men. Well, Abishai is chasing Abner, and he's got Abner on the run. He's going to be able to catch up with Abner. He knows he can catch up with Abner, and he's going to catch Abner and kill him. If you think about warfare in these days, it's very personal, and particularly in a civil war, it's going to be personal. They know the people on the other side, and that both changes warfare, and it makes it a lot more personal, which is has its good side and its bad side. In this case, Abishai is intent on catching Abner, the head of the opposing forces. Abner doesn't want to get caught, and Abner doesn't want to turn on Asahel because he has a personal connection with Asahel's brother Joab in particular. So he doesn't want to kill him. But Asahel is relentless. So on two different occasions, Abner says, "Go get somebody else. I don't want to kill you. Go get somebody else." And Asahel says, Nope, you're in my sights. You're the one I'm after." And just keeps chasing, and I'm sure keeps gaining on him. So Abner is at the place where it's either him or Asahel. So he turns, and with the butt end of the spear, probably was sharp. It's not clear, it depends what kind of spear he's using, but it was not uncommon for the butt end of the spear to be sharp, not as sharp as the other end, but you would stick it into the ground sometimes when you have the enemy coming on against you. So it's probably not completely dull. It has some sharpness to it. But he runs Asahel through with that end of the spear. And I suspect that it was gory, a gory sight, even for these hardened soldiers. I think that's why it says that when people came by, they stood still. When they saw this sight, they stood still. I mean, it could have been out of respect for Asahel, but I suspect that this battle got very personal and very ugly. And I suspect that his death was a particularly gruesome one because of the events that follow. Next section. But Joab and Abishai pursued Abner, and when the sun was going down, They came to the hill of Ammah, which is in front of Gia, by way of the wilderness of Gibeon. And the sons of Benjamin gathered together behind Abner and became one band, and they stood on the top of a certain hill. Then Abner called to Joab and said, "Shall the sword devour forever? Do you not know that it will be bitter in the end? How long will you refrain from telling the people to turn back from following their brothers?" And Joab said, "As God lives, if you had not spoken, surely then the people would have gone away in the morning, each from following his brother." So Joab blew the trumpet, and all the people halted and pursued Israel no longer, nor did they continue to fight anymore. Abner and his men then went through the Arabah all that night. So they crossed the Jordan, walked all morning, and came to Mahanaim. So the Israelites won the 12-on-12 battle. The men of David won the 12-on-12 battle, and then they've driven back the forces of Abner. Abner and his men have retreated to a hill, and Joab and his forces are hot in pursuit of Abner's men. But at that time, a group of Benjaminites join Abner and his forces, and it creates a standoff. They now have enough men to keep back Joab and his forces. So they enter into negotiations, Abner and Joab, speaking back and forth to one another. And Abner says, "Let's have a truce. Why should we just keep killing each other? How long are you going to wait? Are you going to keep from telling your men to back off?" And Joab says, "As God lives, if you had not spoken, surely then the people would have gone away in the morning, each from following his brother." I think what he's saying is, you started it. If it hadn't been from you wanting to have apparently the 12-on-12 battle early on, that this never would have happened. And I think what Joab is suggesting is this spun out of control, and this got really vicious, and Joab is still, it feels like he has a score to settle. But Joab relents, calls off his men, and as a result, Abner and his forces leave. They walk all night, go across the Arabah, go to the other side of the Jordan, back to Mahanaim. And the last section. Then Joab returned from following Abner when he had gathered all the people together. 19 of David's servants besides Asahel were missing. But the servants of David had struck down many of Benjamin and Abner's men, so that 360 men died. And they took up Asahel, buried him in his father's tomb, which is in Bethlehem. Then Joab and his men went all night until the day dawned at Hebron. So counting up the dead, there were 19 of David's men that were killed, as opposed to 360 of Abner's men that were killed in this melee. They buried Asahel, buried him at Bethlehem, which would have been fairly close by. And then Joab and his men walk all night long back to Hebron. So both armies have spent all night walking in opposite directions. Just a few comments. It is curious in this text the role that the Amalekites play. They keep showing up. And in Saul's interaction with the Amalekites, he always loses with respect to the Amalekites. Amalekites always, in one way or another, they're kind of the bane of his existence. Even when he defeats them in battle, he gets in trouble for it with God because of his disobedience. So the Amalekites become this this association with Saul of his failure. So it's particularly ironic that according to the story of this one Amalekite, that Saul is actually finally put to death by an Amalekite. Whether that happened or not, that's the story that he gives, and it is ironic. David, on the other hand, is always successful against the Amalekites. And the Amalekites then are this indication of God's blessing on David and his turning against Saul and Saul's failure and faithlessness. Second thing I'd like to point out. David, in the way that he deals with, once he becomes king of Judah, and the way that he deals with Jabesh-Gilead, the men who had taken Saul and Saul's sons' bodies and buried them, David is very appreciative of what those men had done. And so it's a very generous gesture on his part to send messengers to the people of Jabesh-Gilead, thanking them. I find it interesting that as you read through Saul, David's actions, everyone can be seen as, during this period of time, everyone can be seen as purely political and self-serving politically. We saw after he defeated the Amalekites, he sent portions of the loot that he had taken to the various villages of Hebron. Well, that's astute politically. So you can see, it's possible to interpret what David is doing here as just being very astute politically, being even Machiavellian, buying votes. And if that's the case, then his gesture towards Jabesh-Gilead is not a noble one. But I think that it would be unfair to read David that way. I think he is actually being noble. It just turns out that being noble is sometimes politic. And I think that's the better reading of the text here, that David is genuinely grateful to the people of Jabesh-Gilead. He was genuinely grateful to the people in the villages of Hebron that had helped him throughout the years. Third thing that I'd like to point out is something that I've talked about before, but the text is impressing it upon us, so I think I will impress it upon us as well. This period of time between when David was promised that he would be the king of Israel and the time that he becomes the king of Israel is extremely protracted. If you were in David's shoes, I'm sure even after you're anointed, then you're thinking, okay, when's this going to happen and how's this going to happen? Saul turns against him. And it looks like David's going to die before he becomes king. And he goes through that period of time when Saul is chasing him all over Judah. Then he goes into Philistia, and Saul still wants to kill him. And being in Philistia, it looks like he's further from being king of Israel than he's ever been. Well, now Saul is dead. And I suspect David's thinking, okay, now it's going to happen. But it doesn't happen. There is a civil war that takes place for at least 7.5 years before David finally becomes king. God loves delayed gratification. I mean, it's amazing how God has protracted this out, keeps stretching it out. And yet it's a promise that David holds on to. But if you're in David's shoes, you got to be thinking, not now. I mean, when is this going to happen? Is it really going to happen? And then the last thing I'd like to point out is this civil war that erupts at the end is the source of a lot of bad blood then that exists within the people of Israel. And it's going to take a long time for this to play out. This conflict in particular between Joab And Abner is going to have consequences as we get further down the line. Civil wars are nasty things, and this is no exception. It was a nasty thing that created a lot of animosity within the people of Israel themselves. Okay, questions, comments?
Well, what kind of strikes me in this is that even after David's given the promise, he still has to, quote, do a lot of legwork. In other words, he can't sit still. Mm-hmm. I mean, he knows he's going to be king, but he does have to flee from
yes.
Saul.
Yeah.
And I'm just wondering what kind of parallel you see with us today mm-hmm. and how God deals with us mm-hmm. sometimes, because I think there's a tendency, I even notice it among myself, like, okay, God, you said you're going to do this, but mm-hmm. I'm having to do this. I mean, what's going on?
Yeah. I think that's very interesting. I've been thinking about that. In fact, two people after I talked last Sunday brought up the same thing, and I think it's very interesting. David has been given this promise that he's going to be the king. And yet he spends years ducking every time a bullet is shot at him. He doesn't just stand there and say, I'm going to be king.
Yeah.
And so his day-to-day life is trying to figure out, okay, what do I do next? What's the next step towards this goal that has been promised to me? And I think that's fascinating. And I think that that's one of the reasons why studying the Old Testament is so important, because the Old Testament is kind of giving us a slice of life that we don't get in the New Testament. And that slice of life is, how does one conduct oneself on a day-to-day basis? How does one think about this world that God has created? We get more of that kind of information in the Old Testament than you get in the New Testament. The New Testament takes that for granted. It's assuming that the readers of the New Testament know that stuff well. Now let's put things into perspective. And so it can state things in a way that could be misunderstood in the absence of that Old Testament background. I think that this is particularly interesting in light of thinking in terms of free will and divine sovereignty in particular. Because there's no question, but what we're seeing here is David as a free will agent, having to make difficult decisions on a day-to-day basis. But he also believes that God is fully in control of everything. So we have a living example of that difficult thing to understand being played out in front of our eyes. And I think that helps us then to understand the statements that we find in the New Testament. And my suspicion is that we could say that with respect to a lot of different doctrines that are taught in the New Testament, that we really need the Old Testament background in order to understand them correctly.
Yeah. Well, I was just kind of wondering, how can I say, like with us today, kind of learn from some of the things David approached these problems and how he dealt with them,
mm-hmm.
you know, in our own life.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I don't know, something promises we can think that God gave us and so on. But, I think thinking about the Old Testament, looking at that, I guess you could say it's almost more of a filling out of the mundane aspects that the New Testament takes
mm-hmm.
for granted.
Mm-hmm. It's, you get... there are a lot more examples of people making the kinds of decisions that we make all the time and struggling with those. And some people making good decisions, some people making bad decisions, but we can all identify with that difficult decision-making process that people go through.
Yeah, and if I could bring in Abraham as kind of encouragement, because to be honest, he made some really bad decisions, but the promise was fulfilled.
He makes some really good decisions as well, which are remarkable.
The reason why I brought out bad decisions is we kind of tend, I think, sometimes to punish ourselves for those. And sometimes almost want to think God's not going to do this because we've done that.
David is going to make some horrendous bad decisions as we go on. So I think we're seeing real life people here, and I find that very encouraging. We see both the good and the bad of them, and yet God working through that, accomplishing his purposes, and I take great comfort from that.
I actually just had a historical question, because I'm rusty on, you said that the Civil War went on for 7.5 years. Is that then when the kingdoms are unified under David at the end of that? Is that why it says he was king of Judah for 7.5 years?
Yes, okay. Yes. So we have a period of time which is apparently last 7.5 years when David is only king of Judah, and the rest of Israel, at least at the beginning, probably isn't under any unified rule, but it looks like under Abner's efforts, after 5.5 years, he's able to establish Ishbosheth as king over all of Israel except for Judah. And then a war continues on for a couple of years between Israel and Judah.
I've always been fascinated and curious by mention of the high places, and so I was appreciated your factual comment about it today. It seems in some places I'm familiar with and very loosely that they also are a metaphor for our heart towards God. Like there's a passage in 2 Chronicles where God has done all these amazing things, and then afterwards there's a section where it says, but the high places were not removed. And the implication there is their hearts had still not.
Okay.
So I'd love to hear any more thoughts you have on the high places even more broadly, and are they in fact a metaphor for other things?
Well, the high places were created by the Canaanites. It was part of their religion. They would build a stone wall about 4 feet high, and that's filled with dirt in the middle, and then they would make their sacrifices on that. And the significance of that is the Israelites, when they come into Canaan, periodically you'll see mention of the high places, usually mentioned by the prophets, because the Israelites are reverting, or they're mimicking the practices of the Canaanites. And whenever they mimic the practices of the Canaanites, it's an indication that they have, in one way or another, fallen away from God and his principles. So whenever you see mention of the high places, it usually is indicative of Israel losing its focus. People in Israel hedging their bets. They usually continue to worship Yahweh in some way. They may even worship Yahweh on the high places. But it's always a way of kind of hedging their bets, because if God is good, if Yahweh is good insurance, Yahweh and Baal is better insurance, is kind of the perspective. So when good kings come in, if they're good, usually what it will say about them is they tore down the high places. So the high places becomes kind of symbolic of that that tendency that we as humans have to not really be trusting in God, that you're always kind of making sure you've got all your bases covered because you aren't sure that God is up to the task. So it's that lukewarmness, it's that thing that haunts all of us in various ways.
Hey, David. I don't think I understand this, how special the Anointed One is, because it seems like the Amalekite that killed Saul, if we're going by his story, he did what Saul asked him to. Mm-hmm. And when he gets to David, he seems to be in mourning. He seems to, I mean, if the Philistines are coming and your king is dead and, you know, there's somebody else but anointed, well, it seems like you're going to take the jewels and the symbols of authority and run with it to the other king. And so by his story, it seems like he would have done the right thing. I don't know why it would be wrong for him to have killed Saul mm-hmm. when Saul asked him to. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Right. In David's mind, the anointed is a huge big deal. That the anointed is that person that God has established on this earth to be his representative. And even if that person is a scoundrel, that person has been put there by God and as such needs to be respected. And there are some things in particular that you don't do to the anointed. And it's any sign of disrespect, but I think killing is, you don't kill the anointed, is one of those. Now, I'm sure you're saying, well, it was just, he asked him to do it. It was mercy killing. But I think from David's perspective, he would have seen it just like the armor bearer did. The armor bearer, Saul asked the armor bearer to kill him. And the armor bearer is saying, I can't do it. I can't bring myself to do that. That would be against every fiber in my being because you are the anointed. A mere human being doesn't kill the anointed. And I think, I don't know what David would say about mercy killing elsewhere, but the anointed, there's no way. That's inconceivable. Go on. No, come back.
I don't get it. I don't see why that would, just because he is the anointed, I don't know why that would stop one from killing him. Is it that, I mean, I see that he's the guy that God's put his finger on and said, mm-hmm. this is my guy, you listen to him. But part of listening is obeying his commands and killing him if he asks you to.
Yeah. Well, I suspect that David's perspective would be, he's the anointed. God has to choose when he goes. It's not, he doesn't even get to choose when he goes, nor his Amalekite walker by. But I think that in addition to that, I think that David has picked up other indications that this Amalekite was not respectful towards the anointed. To loot his body the way he did afterwards, I think David sees all of that as awfully shady. He's just not respectful towards... He's not treating Saul with the respect that one should treat the anointed. And I think David's picked up on a number of clues that that's the case, and that's why he has him put to death. But my suspicion is that if the armor bearer had killed Saul, David would have wanted him to be put to death as well.
I think that works.
And would Saul's suicide have been seen as something dishonorable, like disrespectful of the position that God put
well,
him in?
Well, I'm inclined to think yes. I really do think that's a hard one. But I think that it is wrong to take one's own life. And even in those circumstances, I think it's probably wrong. It's a difficult one. And it's an understandable one. As I think about ways that I would like to go, being tortured to death by the Philistines is not high on the list. I am very sympathetic with Saul. But I mentioned this, I think, last week, but I do appreciate Jack's distinction between a failure of faith and a failure of courage, and that it's possible to have a failure of courage without having a failure of faith, that one can be faithful overall and yet in a moment not be able to do what one is supposed to do. I think that can happen. But I think ultimately, yes, it was wrong for him to kill himself.
But not just because he was anointed, but because he was a man. That would have been why it was wrong. Or is it doubly wrong because he's also the anointed?
Well, I'm inclined to think just because he's a man it's wrong. But you do up the stakes a bit when it's the anointed. I think that's true.
I can understand, I guess, David's respect of Saul as the anointed, but why is it that he speaks so highly of him? I mean, in his song? Yeah, I mean, in his song he says, beloved, Saul and Jonathan, beloved and pleasant in their life.
Yeah.
He doesn't seem like he was that beloved and pleasant.
Well, my suspicion is he liked Saul. He genuinely liked Saul. Saul went crazy. I mean, Saul, and I think David understood that that was the case, and that Saul in his better moments was likable, and I think that he understood the weaknesses of Saul that drove him to where he got, and David could understand that. And I'm inclined to think that he genuinely liked Saul. I don't think he's making this up. Last one.
Okay. Well, it sounds like that there was someone that was close enough to, you know, Saul at the end, you know, hear him ask to be killed, and then observe the armor bearer killing himself, and then observing Amalekai coming up and taking stuff, and then that story got, you know, it was either told David or it got back to David somehow, and also got to the narrator who wrote it all up. But so what I think David probably knew, you know, that exactly what happened from, you know, this other observer that got into the narration. So when the Amalekai came to him, he knew there's, you know, the Amalekai is wanting something, you know, some sort of exchange of favor, and he just wasn't going to stand for it. And that was it.
Could be. Yeah, I don't know if David knew anything. I mean, that's pretty fast to get information. So I don't know that David had received any other reports before the Amalekite came.
Yeah. Well, if the Amalekite thought to go to David, somebody else may have also. But we don't know.
Yeah, we don't know. But the narrator got his information somewhere, so there probably were other witnesses, and I suspect that the real story got pieced together. I think the Amalekite probably was on the mount when it happened and saw it, just added his little flourishes. Okay, thanks.